Grimm in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The reason why I resigned is really because I could no longer be a part of the State Department and promote this policy. It's an inhumane policy. It's a failed policy that is helping neither Palestinians, neither Israelis.
As Israel's devastating siege on northern Gaza intensifies, we'll speak with Halil Arat, the first and only U.S. career diplomat to resign from the State Department over U.S. policy on Israel. We'll talk about Gaza, Israel's bombing of Lebanon, and U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken's visit to the region. He's now in Saudi Arabia after leaving Israel. Then to Puerto Rico, where a pro-independence party is hoping to make history in next month's election. We'll speak to Ana Irma Rivera Lacen, who's running to be Puerto Rico's sole member of Congress, albeit a non-voting member.
Our position is to give the people of Puerto Rico a different option that moves us beyond the disaster. It's more important than the selfishness of thinking only about the parties. We united from that point of view to give Puerto Rico an alternative that provides answers to the people of Puerto Rico in the face of this scary corruption that exists.
And as New York Mayor Eric Adams resists calls to resign after being indicted on federal corruption charges, we'll speak to New York State lawmaker Zohran Mamdani. He's just announced he'll run for mayor next year as a Democratic Socialist. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, has accused the Israeli military of committing ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza as its devastating siege continues for a 19th day. In the Jabalia refugee camp, Israeli forces stormed at least three schools sheltering Palestinians, forcing those inside to leave at gunpoint before setting fire to the buildings. Palestinians fleeing the shattered remains of Beit Lahia report seeing bodies in the streets and Israeli soldiers detaining and beating men. The stench of death is everywhere. This comes as a United Nations report published Tuesday found 1 year of Israeli attacks on Gaza has set back the territory's economic development nearly seven decades, plunging three of every four surviving Palestinians into poverty, with Israeli strikes on civilian infrastructure leaving behind a, quote, vast wasteland of rubble and twisted steel, unquote. The UN warns Palestinians under Israeli siege in northern Gaza, quote, are rapidly exhausting all available means for their survival, unquote. Israel's intensifying its attacks on Lebanon. Earlier today, Israel bombed the historic Lebanese port city of Tyre, one of the oldest cities in the world, after ordering residents to leave their homes and businesses. More Israeli airstrikes hit Beirut's southern suburbs overnight. Israel's army announced it had killed Hashem Safidin, presumed to be the next head of Hezbollah after Israel assassinated its former leader, Hassan Nasrallah, in an airstrike in September. On Tuesday, Lebanese cabinet member Nasser Yassin said Lebanon will need $250 million a month to help over a million people who've been displaced by Israel's assault. He spoke ahead of an international summit on Lebanon taking place in Paris later this week.
You know, overnight, we've seen more than 1 million people being displaced by the attacks, hostilities, by the aggression. And this is similar to an earthquake. you don't see this number in its scale and the speed of it, except in major natural disasters. And this is what happened in 48 hours.
Meanwhile, the Financial Times reports Israel's military forcibly entered a clearly marked United Nations base and is suspected of using the incendiary chemical white phosphorus close enough to injure 15 peacekeepers. The use of white phosphorus as a weapon is a war crime under international law. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers fatally shot an 11-year-old Palestinian child during a raid Tuesday in the city of Nablus. Abdul Hawash was critically injured and later died of his wounds. Over the past year, Israeli forces have killed at least 760 Palestinians in the West Bank, while more than 11,400 have been arrested in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's arrived in Saudi Arabia after wrapping up talks with senior Israeli officials in Tel Aviv. The State Department says Blinken urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to revive Gaza ceasefire negotiations and pushed Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza. On Tuesday evening, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Tel Aviv hotel where Blinken was meeting with Israeli President Isaac Herzog. They were demanding the U.S. pressure Israel into making a ceasefire deal that would see the release of hostages held by Hamas. The protesters, most of them family members of hostages, held signs reading, "No more war, no more bloodshed, free our state, free our hostages." Blinken's 11th trip to the Middle East in just over a year comes as Axios reports the State Department is reviewing U.S. aid to Israeli units accused of killing, torturing and sexually assaulting Palestinians. ProPublica reported in April that a State Department panel had recommended as long ago as last December that multiple Israeli military and police units should be disqualified from receiving U.S. aid under the Leahy Amendment, the 1997 law that requires the United States to cut off financial aid to those credibly accused of human rights violations. Secretary Blinken still has not taken any action. Al Jazeera is continuing to demand for the immediate medical evacuation of two of its journalists in Gaza injured in Israeli attacks. Al Jazeera camera operator Fadi Al-Wahidi was paralyzed after he was shot in the neck by an Israeli sniper while reporting in Jabalia earlier this month. Israeli authorities have blocked the evacuation of Al-Wahidi from Gaza, as well as that of fellow Al Jazeera camera person Ali Al-Attar, to receive urgently needed medical treatment. Al-Attar suffered serious injuries due to shrapnel from an Israeli airstrike in Deir al-Balah, causing a cerebral hemorrhage. In related news, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders is leading a group of U.S. lawmakers urging the Biden administration to open an investigation into the October 2023 Israeli attack that killed Reuters video journalist Issam Abdallah in southern Lebanon. Six others were injured, including reporters for Agence France-Presse and Al Jazeera. Leaders of the BRICS alliance, led by Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, have gathered in the Russian city of Kazan. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is attending the summit. Its host, Russian President Vladimir Putin, said over 30 countries have expressed a desire to join BRICS this year. As the summit opened, U.S. Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused North Korea of deploying troops to Russia. He's the first U.S. official to make the claim after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused North Korea of assisting Russia's occupation of Ukraine. This follows a mutual defense pact signed by Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in June. Former President Trump's longest-serving chief of staff has warned Trump meets the definition of a fascist. Retired Marine General John Kelly made the remarks in an on-the-record interview with the New York Times.
Well, I'm looking at the definition of fascism. It's a far-right, authoritarian, ultra-nationalist political ideology and movement characterized by a dictatorial leader, centralized autocracy, militarism, forcible suppression of opposition, belief in a natural social hierarchy. So certainly, in my experience, those are the kind of things that he thinks would work better in terms of running America.
Trump's former chief of staff, Kelly, said Trump's recent comments about employing the military against domestic opponents had left him deeply bothered. He recounted that Trump said on several occasions, quote, Hitler did some good things, too, unquote. Separately, The Atlantic magazine reports Trump said during a private meeting at the White House, quote, I need the kind of generals Hitler had, unquote. Trump also reportedly referred to 20-year-old U.S. Army soldier Vanessa Guillen, whose 2020 murder at Fort Hood in Texas brought global attention to the epidemic of sexual violence in the U.S. military. Trump reportedly referred to her as a, quote, effing Mexican, though Trump used the expletive. Trump reportedly ordered his then-chief of staff, Mark Meadows, not to pay for Guillen's funeral, something the military had promised to do. Kamala Harris's campaign has said it regrets a decision to eject a Muslim American Democrat from a Monday evening rally in Metro Detroit, where Harris was joined on stage by Republican former Wyoming Congress member Liz Cheney. Ahmed Ghanem, a Democratic Party activist, former House candidate for Michigan's 11th District, says he RSVP'd to the event, cleared security, was seated at the Royal Oak Musical Theater when a staffer ordered him to leave or be put into the back of a police car. Ghanem told the Detroit News he felt targeted because he's Muslim, adding, quote, I didn't even have anything like a Palestinian keffiyeh, any signs or a banner, nothing. None of that is allowed inside. I guess that's how the Democratic Party deals with Muslims, he said. This comes as a new poll from Arab News finds Arab Americans are slightly more likely to vote for Donald Trump than Kamala Harris. Georgia's Supreme Court has declined to reinstate election rules approved by a partisan pro-Trump majority on the Georgia State Election Board. Among other things, the new rules would have required ballots to be hand-counted, potentially delaying results and sowing chaos on election night. Here in New York, a federal judge has ordered former mayor, a former Trump attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to turn over his luxury Manhattan apartment and other prized possessions to a pair of Georgia election workers whom Giuliani falsely accused of committing election fraud during ballot counting operations in 2020, leading to a torrent of death threats from Trump supporters against them. Ruby Freeman and her daughter Shay Moss were awarded $146 million last year after Giuliani was found liable for defaming them. Along with his apartment, Giuliani will have to hand over his collection of luxury watches, signed baseball memorabilia, and a 1980 Mercedes-Benz previously owned by actor Lauren Bacall. The judge has given him 7 days. Here in New York, the trial for a white former U.S. Marine who choked black street performer Jordan Neely to death on a subway train in May of last year began this week in a Manhattan court. Daniel Penny's facing charges of second-degree manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide for holding Neely in a chokehold until he died. Neely, a 30-year-old beloved street performer, was unhoused and hungry and crying out for help when the ex-Marine attacked him. Neely was well known to New Yorkers and tourists as a talented Michael Jackson impersonator. In Mozambique, more protests have erupted over allegations of fraud in the October 9th presidential and parliamentary elections. European Union poll observers on Tuesday noted irregularities during counting and unjustified alteration of election results at polling station and district level and urged transparency from Mozambique's election authorities. Protesters took to the streets of the capital Maputo, despite a violent crackdown by Mozambique security forces.
Our rights to protest as Mozambican citizens gave me the will to go to the streets. What is happening in the country are things which I do not understand. There are killings, kidnappings, and we end up not understanding who is behind it. And automatically, Mozambique is not safe anymore.
And end, the UN Biodiversity Conference, known as COP16, has opened in Cali, Colombia, as indigenous and environmental activists demand world leaders enact bolder actions to protect an estimated 1 million plant and animal species threatened by extinction, most of them due to human activity. The conference is taking place as experts warn humanity is on the precipice due to worsening biodiversity loss and the catastrophic impacts of the climate crisis. This is Colombia's Environment Minister, Susana Mohammed.
This should be an international priority. Resources for war, trillions of dollars are immediately handed out. In 1 week, billions of dollars were given for military weapons and bombs. But we take years to obtain fair financing at the scale we need it when we talk about the most important issue, to defend life. This is what creates inclusive safety for everyone and provides a chance of survival for younger generations.
Among the demands are the implementation of a $20 billion fund for global biodiversity protection that was approved in 2022, which wealthier nations have failed to contribute to as promised, as well as financial support for indigenous communities that are in the front lines of biodiversity protection. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, has accused Israel of committing ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza as Israel's devastating siege on the area continues. In a statement, the group said, quote, "The magnitude of the crimes Israel's currently committing in the northern Gaza Strip and its campaign to empty it of however many residents are left is impossible to describe, not just because hundreds of thousands of people enduring starvation, disease without access to medical care, and incessant bombardments and gunfire defies comprehension, but because Israel has cut them off from the world." These are the words of the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. In the Jabalia refugee camp, Israeli forces stormed at least three schools, forcing Palestinians sheltering inside to leave at gunpoint before setting fire to the buildings. Palestinians in the refugee camp say they fear they'll be killed if they stay put or if they try to flee south.
A lot of rockets fell on us, and the quadcopters started shouting and telling us to get out of the area. We evacuated and found lots of tanks and Israeli soldiers, and we were taken to a very large area, and they started shooting at us. They then started evacuating us from the area 10 by 10. When we reached here, I didn't know where to come or go. I'm sitting in the street with my children.
This comes as the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, has issued a report stating it could take Gaza 350 years to rebuild if it remains under an Israeli blockade. Meanwhile, Israel is also intensifying its attack on Lebanon. Earlier today, Israel bombed the historic Lebanese town of Tyre, one of the oldest cities in the world. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken's arrived in Saudi Arabia after leaving Israel, where he met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other officials. Blinken spoke to reporters before leaving Israel.
Israel has achieved most of its strategic objectives when it comes to Gaza, all with the idea of making sure that October 7th could never happen again. In the space of a year, it's managed to dismantle Hamas's military capacity. It's destroyed much of its arsenal. It's eliminated its senior leadership, including, most recently, Yahya Sinwar. This has come at the cost, great cost, to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Now is the time to turn those successes into an enduring strategic success. And there are really two things left to do. Get the hostages home and bring the war to an end with an understanding of what will follow.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken. We're joined now by Hala Rarit. She served 18 years as a career diplomat before resigning in April from the State Department over the Biden administration's Gaza policy. She's the first and only State Department diplomat to publicly resign over Gaza. At the time she left, she was the Arabic language spokesperson for the State Department and the deputy director of the State Department's Dubai Regional Media Hub. Hala Rarit, thank you so much for being in our New York studio. We were just playing a clip of your former boss, of U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken. Your thoughts as we just passed this first anniversary of the Hamas attack on southern Israel and the ensuing Israeli attack on Gaza that has killed, this is by far considered an underestimate by most, at least 42,000 Palestinians, over 17,000 of them children.
First of all, Amy, thank you so much for having me. It really is an honor, and I have to tell you, on behalf of so many diplomats, huge fan of yours. American diplomats have been watching your show for years, and we thank you for everything that you do. In response to the onslaught of Gaza, I want to state the failures of this policy, that even for those that are thinking of it as this side versus another, we have to be realistic about the fact that it has absolutely failed. Secretary Blinken said Israel has achieved the strategic objectives in Gaza. No, it hasn't. That is quite a lie. Its objectives was the release of the hostages. That has not been achieved. Its objective was also the destruction of Hamas. That has not been achieved. The reality is that we, as the United States government, are in violation of U.S. law, of a multiple of laws that your viewers can Google for themselves, the Leahy Law, the Foreign Assistance Act, the Arms Export Control Act. We continue to willfully violate laws so that we surge U.S. military assistance to Israel. To what end? We are only empowering Benjamin Netanyahu to expand the conflict in Gaza, to expand the conflict within the West Bank, and now we're seeing the devastation in Lebanon. Again, to what end? We saw the Lebanese foreign minister insist that Nasrallah and Hezbollah had actually agreed to the U.S. and France proposal for a ceasefire before he was assassinated. There are other ceasefires in Gaza that we have been pushing, that Netanyahu is the obstacle. Yet this administration refuses to shift its policy, refuses to enforce U.S. law, and continues to surge U.S. military assistance. And the result has been devastating, absolutely devastating. These are human beings in Gaza that are being absolutely massacred, children. And this is going to have generational impacts and ultimately will not keep Israel any safer. And the entire region is destabilized, as we're seeing now with the threat of Iran as well. The policy has to change, and it has to change now.
And Hala, I wanted to ask you, it wasn't until earlier this month that Secretary of State Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin sent Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a letter threatening to cut off U.S. military assistance if Israel does not boost humanitarian aid to Gaza in the next 30 days. What's your response?
Thank you, Juan, for highlighting that. I can tell you, as someone that worked within the State Department PR machine, that this, unfortunately, is a public relations ploy. I'm sad to say it, but it's the truth. It is conveniently 30 days, marking the time after the election. Also, it was conveniently leaked. It's not typical for a statement like this to be leaked to the press, but it was. The reality is that the State Department and the administration at this point is trying to give voters, especially those that are so concerned about the conflict in Gaza, some level of hope. As long as you vote for us, after this 30 days, we'll enforce the law, and we will make a change. This is absolutely a deception for the voters and for the American people. We don't need another 30 days. We have had ample evidence from within the United States government, not just the State Department, but a multitude of U.S. agencies with proof that Israel is violating so many of our laws, is systematically withholding humanitarian assistance from going in. As it was mentioned in the report as well, Leahy vetting is being violated, with army units determined to have committed gross human rights violations. We need to take action, and we should have taken action months ago. This 30 days is only a PR ploy, and that is the only thing it really is, and that's the devastation of all of it, because we have to ask ourselves, what is going to happen in these 30 days? Right after this letter was sent, the Israeli government announced that medical groups were no longer allowed to go into Gaza. They informed the WHO. These are medical groups, including from the United States, that are providing life-saving assistance to people in need, to civilians in need. This was a slap in the face to the administration. If they had actually taken this letter seriously, they wouldn't have taken that step. Additionally, the onslaught of northern Gaza is clear. They're continuing the onslaught specifically of northern Gaza, a complete blackout, no food, no water, no internet, all this in this 30-day period, supposedly. Unfortunately, we need to stop with the words, with the PR, and we need to take serious action.
And I wanted to ask you, even as the war, this horrific war continues, the United States policy and that of most European countries is still in favor of a two-state solution long term in the area. But the Israeli Knesset itself, overwhelmingly, not just Netanyahu's portion of the government, but overwhelmingly voted earlier this year to reject any possibility of a Palestinian state. I'm wondering your thoughts about the long-term future of the area.
You're absolutely right. And the fact that the Knesset voted on that shows the fact that we, as the United States, have been enabling and empowering a right extremist government in Israel. And it's time that we stop doing so. There are so many Israeli peace activists. We heard of B'Tselem, but there is a growing movement from within Israel, including members that family members that actually lost relatives on October 7th, that are demanding an end to the nonstop violence. These are the groups that we need to support. Same on the Palestinian side, Palestinian activists that are calling for coexistence. The U.S. government needs to shift its policy. Again, I'm just going to repeat this over and over again. We continue to empower a right-wing extremist prime minister when we should be doing is supporting civil society on both sides that are actually seeking to promote humanity for both peoples.
Hala, tributes have poured in from across the globe for 19-year-old Shaban Al-Dalou. He was a software engineering student who burned to death after Israel bombed Gaza's Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Deir al-Balah last week. He didn't actually die then, but the bombing set fire to the displaced persons camp around the hospital. He had built his little tent area for his family. This is a clip of Zateo News reporter Prem Thakur questioning recently State Department spokesperson Matt Miller about Shaban's death.
One of the people the world saw burned alive by the bombing at the Gaza hospital was Shaban Al-Dalou, a 19-year-old engineering student who was still attached to an IV drip recovering from a previous bombing. And his story kind of speaks to how this isn't just about one attack. A 19-year-old having to provide for his family, repeatedly displaced, brought to hunger, bombed twice in a matter of days. This is a year and this isn't out of nowhere. So how many more patients burned alive by U.S.
bombs? We don't want to see any. We don't want to see any.
Well, I guess the U.S. has said, you know, again and again, that no civilian loss is acceptable 10,000 deaths ago, 20,000 deaths ago, and yet it's continued. So how does this answer mean anything without a policy shift?
It is an incredibly difficult environment that Israel operates in. And I'll just make clear the thing that question leaves out, as often happens, and I understand why, is the burden that Hamas bears. And not just the burden that Hamas bears by hiding behind humans and using humans as civilian shields, but the burden that Hamas bears in not coming back to the table to try to get to a ceasefire. So Israel needs to do more to minimize civilian harm. Hamas needs to stop hiding behind human shields.
So that's State Department spokesperson Matt Miller being questioned by Zateo News reporter Prem Thakur. Hala, if you can respond to this report. And, you know, since Shaban has died, his brother has died, his mother has died, his sister has died, and people are saying that the family members who are burnt but not yet dead because they can't get out and because the hospital is in such disrepair, they are dying from their burns.
Such immense human suffering, the scale of which we just can't really grapple with. And I have to just thank you, Amy, for humanizing the victims. And we all have to do that as Americans, because ultimately it is our bombs, it is our tax dollars that is creating this catastrophe. As to Matthew Miller, I'm going to be unequivocal. He's lying. And I realize it's quite of a forceful thing for me to say, but as a former diplomat, I can assure that there have been ceasefire deals that Hamas has agreed to. I am not one to advocate for the terrorist organization whatsoever, and I want to be clear about that. But facts are facts. Hamas has repeatedly agreed to ceasefire deals. It is Benjamin Netanyahu, who has reneged on those deals. Additionally, you had another guest on this show a while back, Gershon Baskin, who's an Israeli negotiator who has been negotiating on behalf of families of hostages. I have been in close touch with Gershon over the last month. He had and continues to have a deal that, again, is an Israeli deal that Hamas has agreed to. I pushed this to the State Department. I pushed this to the White House at very senior levels. They have it, and it guaranteed the release of all of the hostages and guaranteed security for Israel as well. I'm sorry, go ahead.
We have a clip
of
Gershon Baskin.
I have pleaded with Hamas to say yes, not only to me, but to tell the Egyptians and the Qataris that they agree to the deal that I proposed to them, which is a three-week end of war, full-term ceasefire, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, release of all the Israeli hostages, and a release of an agreed number and list of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. This is a deal that can be made. It is a million times better than the deal that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt have been trying to negotiate unsuccessfully for the last 3 months, which would just keep the war going and only release 32 hostages in 42 days. That's a bad deal. We need to have a good deal put on the table. I've communicated this to the White House, to the Qataris, to the Egyptians, and of course to the Israeli government. Now the officials need to push this through.
Why is Netanyahu refusing?
Well, it's very clear that Netanyahu doesn't want to end the war, as one of his top negotiators told me on Saturday. The problem with any agreement that we can put forward is that the bottom line is that Hamas won't make an agreement that doesn't end the war, and Netanyahu won't agree to any agreement that ends the war. He wants to keep this going.
That was Gershon Baskin speaking last month. It was before Yahya Sinwar was assassinated. Gershon Baskin, the Israeli researcher and peace activist who's negotiated agreements with Hamas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The significance of what he is just saying, and also, I mean, Tony Blinken was your boss. Mm-hmm. You would brief him. Mm-hmm. You translated his words to the Arab world mm-hmm. and the messages, and talk about the moment that you decided you cannot do this anymore.
Honestly, there were many moments, Amy, many, many moments. And after an 18-year career, you don't take the decision to resign lightly. But it was, despite all of my efforts, despite everyone's efforts in terms of us career diplomats, highlighting the inhumanity, the illegality of this policy, the fact that it's such a counterproductive policy that is actually emboldening extremism on all sides. It is only ensuring generational cycle of violence. I was initially told, good, thank you for your feedback. I was actually sending daily reports to the department. That was part of my job as a spokesperson, and I was highlighting what was happening in Gaza from the pan-Arab media. So I thought that my work was helping and feeding into Washington's formulation of what to do next. But it became abundantly clear eventually that the policy was the policy. It was not shifting. I was actually asked in January to stop sending in those reports. Those reports also included the images that were going viral all over the Arab world of children being massacred, oftentimes showing U.S. complicity with fragments of U.S. bomb. Any other circumstance, this would have at least prompted a type of review of our, again, Leahy law, everything else. It didn't. Instead, I was silenced. I was sidelined. And that is something that has been unprecedented for me as an 18-year diplomat. There's always disagreements within the U.S. Foreign Service in terms of policy, but it's always been a spirit of collaboration, a spirit of we want to hear from you, let's talk. This has been different. It has been silenced, and let me tell you, it has sent a chilling effect across the entire, I can speak about the Foreign Service. People have become to self-censor themselves. They're worried. And that hurts us as Americans, because when you have your experts, your U.S. government experts silencing themselves because they're worried about retribution or they're worried about what it will do to their career, we all lose. We lose as American citizens. It doesn't keep us secure. It doesn't keep us safe.
And I'm wondering if you could talk about the impact of all of this and the U.S. position of unequivocal support for Israel has done to the standing of the United States in the Arab and in the world and in the global South.
That's a very good question, Juan. That's actually one of the things that I used to highlight in my daily reports. And I used to show clips and images that were going viral of basically America being determined to be child killers, the country of child killers. after 9/11 and after the war on terror, the U.S. government worked so hard to rehabilitate ties in the Arab world, to improve people-to-people relations. All of that has been devastated. And we are not going to see the repercussions of that. I mean, we are going to feel the repercussions of that for years, decades, generation, because we have lost all credibility. We are seen as a country of double standards. We only care about human rights when it's the human rights of a certain people. We only care about freedom of press when it's when the journalists are not Arab, right? And this is abundantly clear to people across the Arab world and at this point beyond. So unfortunately, we've lost credibility, not in terms of just our U.S. policy with regard to the Middle East, but also on Russia-Ukraine. We don't have a leg to stand on. As a spokesperson before the conflict, I did well over 100 interviews, including on Russia-Ukraine, for example. We can no longer talk about that with any credibility, because the answer is, why do you care about a Ukrainian child, but you don't care about a child in Gaza? What is the difference? And the racism, the blunt, absolutely blunt racism of this administration has been laid bare. And there's it's going to be very, very hard to recover from this in the Arab world, because we've lost, even as I've discussed publicly before, we've lost, quote-unquote, the liberals across the Arab world, the ones who, despite it all, respected us for our values. But those values, even here at home, with the, you know, the student protests being violently beaten down, it's all seen through. They're seeing through all of these double standards, and it's hurting us, again, hurting us as American citizens.
And given the reality of this administration that you resigned from, and that several other career government officials have resigned from, how do you see this election coming in 2 years, in 2 weeks, and the impact of the uncommitted movement, and what you see as an American who's going to have to cast a ballot in this election?
Absolutely. Well, I think the Democratic Party is underestimating the power of this issue. I think they're assuming that people will turn up for Harris because, obviously, the Trump is a threat to our democracy. But I think they're underestimating the trauma, and I don't use that word lightly, the trauma that this conflict has caused, because so many of us that have been focused on the Middle East have been consuming these incessant images of massacres, absolute massacres of children getting killed, of the suffering now in Lebanon, and it's unacceptable. And I think for a lot of people of conscience, they're not going to be able to bring themselves to vote for Harris, even though they understand that Trump is a threat to our democracy, as he surely is. And I think many are taking serious consideration in a third-party option, whether it's the Green Party or another, because they're tired of the institutionalized corruption that has become our government, and they're tired of politicians who are not working on behalf of the United States, but are rather working on behalf of special interest.
Do you know Philip Gordon, who is the national security advisor to Kamala Harris? We're going to have to wrap up in 1 minute. But to ask if you see any distance between Kamala Harris and President Biden.
I don't now. Because those are their own words. They've made it abundantly clear that they're going to continue unconditional support to Israel.
And they need Gordon? To.
I think we've seen too many words, and at this point, action. And Philip Gordon has made it clear that there's going to be no arms embargo. And for me, that is him agreeing to a continuation of violation of U.S. law. And someone that served my country and swore an oath to the Constitution, that's something I cannot accept.
Hala Ararat, we want to thank you so much for being with us. 18-year career diplomat, the first and only career diplomat to resign the State Department over the Biden administration's Gaza policy. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Puerto Rico. Stay with us. Una Velita, a candle by the Puerto Rican musician Bad Bunny. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Less than 2 weeks out from the November 5th election, we look now at how voters in Puerto Rico have a chance to deal a blow against the two parties that have dominated politics there for decades. In a packed conference, press conference in Puerto Rico last week, two Puerto Rican members of Congress, Nidia Velázquez and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, both Democrats of New York, formally endorsed the candidates of the Puerto Rican center-left alliance known as the Alianza, which brings together the Puerto Rican Independence Party and the Citizens Victory Party. Its appeal to Puerto Ricans fed up with corruption scandals, austerity policies, and the disastrous privatization of the electrical grid. This is New York Congressmember Nidia Velázquez, the first Puerto Rican woman to serve in Congress addressing reporters in Spanish.
If political parties with different positions dare to make an alliance to fight for a change in Puerto Rico, the logical step for me is to support them. Today, in front of the sun, I welcome hope and give my endorsement to Juan Del Mal for governor of Puerto Rico, Ana Irma Rivera Lassen for commissioner in Washington, Manuel Natal for mayor of San Juan, and the rest of the candidates of the alliance.
The pro-independence candidate for governor, Juan Del Mal, did not attend the news conference because his wife was in the hospital after suffering a brain aneurysm, is now reportedly in stable yet very delicate condition. This is New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who also spoke in Spanish as she addressed the news conference in San Juan.
I'm here because I know that Puerto Rico is ready for a change. I don't have to say it to the people of Puerto Rico, our communities that have suffered so much from blackouts, storms, because there are two types of disasters, natural disasters, but also disasters of corruption and deficient leadership. Now it's the moment to choose a government that works for all the people and not only a few privileged. The people of Puerto Rico deserve a government free of corruption, false promises, and scandals. The corruption has cost us so much. It has cost lives.
For more, we go to San Juan, where we will speak with one of the candidates who won these ringing endorsements, Ana Irma Rivera Lassen, minority leader in the Puerto Rico Senate, now the first Black and LGBTQ woman running for what's called resident commissioner. That's Puerto Rico's sole member of Congress, albeit a non-voting member. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can talk about the significance of the Alianza, the a party that has pulled together the Puerto Rican Independence Party and the Citizens Victory Party.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. The Alianza is the first opportunity for the people of Puerto Rico, a historic opportunity to push aside the corruption of the government right now and have the opportunity to build a new phase for Puerto Rico. And we are trying to give that opportunity to Puerto Rico, but it's very hard because the main parties, Partido Nuevo Progresista, Partido Popular, is going around a lot of lies because they say that if alliance wins, we are going to try to make Puerto Rico independence, and this is a communist opportunity for Puerto Rico, something like that. So we are pushing aside those lies and trying to people to see that this opportunity really is opportunity for a good governance and Puerto Rico to get out of, for example, the fiscal control board and have the opportunity to grow our economy and our human rights to be defended and all the issues that make us a better society. This is the opportunity, this is a historic opportunity for Puerto Rico.
And Senator, could you talk about the battle that you have had even to be able to run as an alliance? What laws prevented you from having a one-party run?
Yes, precisely. That's one of the examples. We tried to do this in the same ballot, to put the candidate for governor, Juan Dalmau, and in my case, myself for resident commissioner, in only one ballot. But we tried. We went to the court, but they did not allow us to do that. So we decided to do it anyway. And we are running, we call it the Alianza. But people have to vote, for example, for Juan Dalmau in the part of the Puerto Rican Independence Party and have to move to the Citizen Victory Movement, and vote for me. That could be a little difficult, but we are doing a lot of campaign teaching people how to vote, and we hope that people can do it, because it's only to put the name, the cross beside the name, and the cross beside the other name, and all the other ballots, for example, for San Juan El Capito, they only have to put an X under the sign of Movimiento Victoria Ciudadana, Citizen Movement, Victory Movement, because those are all for the Alliance. So we are keeping people in this campaign of how to vote, and I think that's going to be our main issues in these 2 weeks, explaining people, teaching people how to vote for the Alliance. They try to include in, they took out, for example, two of our candidates for the Senate and for the Chamber of Representatives in Puerto Rico. And those are going to be in writing candidates. So they're also in a campaign teaching people how to vote for them. In my case, they try to get out of me also from the ballot. But I went to the federal court because the resident commission is a federal position, and I won, and they had to put me in the ballot. So in my case, I'm in the ballot of the resident commissioner position, and the people can vote for me, just put an X beside my name.
And I wanted to ask you about the situation, continuing problems with the electrical grid in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, of course, and the Financial Control Board managed to privatize the electricity, and Luma Energy came in. But things have, not only has the price of electricity increased, but blackouts have increased as well across the island. Could you talk about the efforts of the government to get rid of Luma, but the control board won't let them?
Well, the government, no efforts to get rid of Luma. Now they're talking about that. But really, the only efforts to get rid of Luma is from our alliance for the Puerto Rican Independence Party and for the movement. We are the only were talking about that before the elections. Now they're talking about get rid of Luma. Luma is the worst contract that you ever believe a country can make with a private contract. We have to talk about that, to explain to people of Puerto Rico that we have to control again the electrical power authority and make it function, because the only way to do that is get out of Luma and start to travel or start to go through the sun or other sources of electricity that you are supposed to do. In Puerto Rico, we are supposed to do that, and they are not doing that neither. So we are talking about get, again, the control of the electrical grid, and also to take the phases to to sun and other sources for electricity.
Ana,
so we're doing that right now.
Ana Irma Rivera Lacen, we want to thank you for being with us, minority leader in the Puerto Rico Senate and the first Black and LGBTQ woman running for resident commissioner, which is the equivalent of a Congress member, albeit non-voting. We'll be speaking to her in Spanish after the broadcast and posting it on our Spanish website. Coming up, is New York Mayor Eric Adams resists calls to resign after being indicted on federal corruption charges. We'll speak with a New York State lawmaker who's just announced he's running for mayor next year. Stay with us. There is a country in the world by the Puerto Rican musician Estrella Artal, released on Paradon Records. That's the label, co-founder Barbara Dane's label. She died this week at the age of 97. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show here in New York, where the city's mayor, Eric Adams, continuing to resist calls to resign after being indicted on federal corruption charges. In recent weeks, at least seven senior city officials have also resigned, leaving the city government in a state of crisis. This comes a year before New Yorkers will vote to pick the next city's mayor. Adams has vowed to run for re-election, but opponents, including fellow Democrats, are lining up to run against him. We're joined now by New York Assembly member Zoran Mamdani, who is just announcing he's joining the race. He is a Ugandan-born democratic socialist who was elected to the New York State Assembly 4 years ago. In fact, very interesting, because in the last year also, you have an interesting record, actually, arrest record. You've been arrested twice, right?
Yes, in the last year.
First time, you were arrested in front of Senator Charles Schumer's house.
Yes.
Protesting?
I was protesting the response, the Israeli military assault on Gaza. This was about a week after October 7th, and we were already seeing war crimes multiplying by the day. And I was protesting alongside Jewish New Yorkers to say, do not let their pain be used as the justification for more.
And the second time you were arrested?
The second time was with New Yorkers and tenant activists outside the Rent Guidelines Board after Mayor Adams' board once again raised rents on more than 2.5 million rent-stabilized tenants across New York City.
Well, Mayor Adams has made history. He's the first sitting New York City mayor to be indicted on federal corruption charge after federal corruption charge. Talk about why you're running.
You know, I'm running partially because of the fact that we have a mayor under federal charges, charges that he has said he will fight with every ounce of strength and spirit in his body, which begs the question, where does that leave working-class New Yorkers? And I'm also running because of the fact that he's been failing those very New Yorkers far before these charges. He is somebody who has run a city that is failing to meet the legal standard of what basic services look like when you're delivering them to the very people that rely on that city to survive.
And given the fact that there is such a large number of people who have already indicated they're going to run or are likely to run, and including the former controller Scott Stringer, the present controller Brad Lander, Jessica Ramos, and even Andrew Cuomo, the former governor, why do you feel that you have a clear shot to be able to win?
You know, I think that a number of members of the political class think that the most pressing issue that is facing New Yorkers right now is the corruption that has engulfed City Hall, or an issue of competence with this mayor. And I think while those are important, the true crisis that most New Yorkers think about on a day-to-day basis is cost of living. And this is a campaign where we are not only going to focus on that crisis relentlessly, but we are beginning it by putting forward three bold proposals that will immediately take action on that very issue. We are going to freeze the rent for every single rent-stabilized tenant for every single year of the mayoralty. We are going to make buses free and fast passed across this entire city, and we are going to enact universal child care at no cost for all New Yorkers for children from the ages of 6 weeks to 5 years. These are the policies that will set us apart, and these are the policies that resonate with New Yorkers' concerns.
But and how do you expect to be dealing with the housing crisis in generally? Because it's not just the rent-stabilized units, but it's all the housing in New York that is so so expensive for the average person.
You know, I think there are a number of tools that the mayor has to confront the housing crisis. To the first point, we have a city of 8.3 million people. Close to 2.5 of them live in rent-stabilized units, which are supposed to be the bedrocks of economic stability. The mayor has raised the rent by rates that we haven't seen since a Republican ran City Hall. And to your point, for New Yorkers who do not live in those units, what they've found as well is that the city is not picking up its tools. The city is not ending brokers' fees. The city is trying to veto an expansion of voucher programs as opposed to leaning into that expansion. And furthermore, there are opportunities for the city to be building 100% affordable housing on 100% publicly owned land. These are some of the clear opportunities we have that I will take as the next mayor of New York City.
And what does it mean to be running as a democratic socialist?
You know, I think it means that I am putting myself forward not simply as an individual, but rather as someone who belongs to a larger tradition, a tradition that says these issues right now are ones that have to be understood at a systemic level. And if we want to provide New Yorkers with the dignity that is required, we need to start making sure that everything they need to live that kind of a life is guaranteed to them, is not something that they can instead be priced out of, as we're seeing today with rent, with childcare, with public transit.
And if you could talk some more about your stance on the war in Gaza, which clearly, or in the Palestinian territories, which clearly is not normally a plank of a candidate for mayor in New York City, but certainly will affect how people vote.
You know, I think there's tremendous anger and alienation across New York City today, whether it's these corruption crises or the cost of living or the fact that our tax dollars are continuing to fund a genocide across Palestine. And what voters are looking for is someone who can speak clearly to that crisis of confidence and of faith in the power of government to be a positive force in people's lives and to offer them a vision that is worth believing in. And that is what I am going to do in this campaign, is to put forward an economic agenda that puts working-class New Yorkers first, all while recognizing the world as it actually is, which is one where there is a hierarchy of human life that the United States government is following that states that it is fine for Palestinians and Lebanese and Syrians and Yemenis to be killed, because that is simply the worth that they have in the eyes of our federal government.
So you are an activist. You get arrested. You go on hunger strike with the taxi drivers in 21, on hunger strike around Gaza in Washington, D.C., a five-day hunger strike. You get arrested. But you're also in the legislature currently, New York, and you introduced not on our dime, Ending New York Funding of Israeli Settler Violence Act. Where has that gone, and what specifically does that say New York State should do?
So what that legislation says is that it should be illegal for New York State nonprofits to fund Israeli war crimes. And if you ask any New Yorker, it is quite common sense to say that charities should not be funding the violation of international human rights. But what we found in New York City and across this country is when you dare to apply universal standards to Israel, you are left as a caricature as opposed to someone standing up for the broad application of universal rights. That is a piece of legislation that I introduced in May of 2023. It is one that has started to increase the number of co-sponsors we've seen in both chambers, and also recently received the support from Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
And also, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but you've promised also to eliminate all bus fares on city buses if you're elected. How would you pay for that?
So that is something that I would use current city revenue towards, as well as use the bully pulpit, the second largest in America, to continue to advocate for what I've been calling for since I got to Albany, which is raising taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers and the wealthiest corporations that do business in New York. What we've seen in the free bus pilot that we won in Albany just 2 years ago is that when you make buses free, ridership increases by 30%, assaults on bus operators drop by nearly 40%, and you get people out of cars and onto public transit. It's time we bring that reality to every New Yorker across across New York City.
Zohran Mamdani, Democratic Socialist New York State Assembly member, is today launching his campaign for New York City mayor. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowship programs. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. And we'll be doing an election night four-hour special. Check it out on our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Two out of three geese. Six out of seven seagulls. And this Transylvanian owl all agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting just for you.